92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
Chairs No Waiting, episode number 530, Things You May Not Know, part 2. Each week, the podcast is brought to you by the fine folks over at WeaversDepartmentStore.com. Head over to Weavers and check it out. They got the new Barbershop Hairstyles print. Go and check that out. It's a reproduction of the one that was on the wall at Foy's Barbershop. You want to have that hanging in your Mayberry wall. They also have Mayberry's Finest Coffee, and this week we'll feature the Sunday Morning Breakfast Blend. So go and check that out over at WeaversDepartmentStore.com. Two Chairs No Waiting is also brought to you by donations from listeners just like you. The executive producer of episode number 530 is Bob and Pat Mundy. Here's our executive producers. Anyway, Bob and Pat, thank you so much for supporting us, and they support us over at Patreon, so thank you. I say us. I should be me because it's basically just me. And who am I? I'm Alan Newsome, your host for Two Chairs No Waiting. It's great to be here with you. I heard from a guy early this week that's talking about starting another podcast, and he had sent me a note and so asked me a bunch of questions. So I ended up calling him, and he was surprised and didn't know I was going to call him. So maybe we'll have another Mayberry podcast coming out soon. But until then, you're stuck with me and Kevin Burke. We're both still plugging along, and we're going to be doing what we did last week. We did Things You May Not Know, and that was I asked if folks were going to enjoy that or not to let me know. And boy, I got a lot of feedback from everybody about that episode. So we're going to do it again this week. Things You May Not Know About the Andy Griffith Show. I love the way that rhymes. And then we're also going to hear from Randy Turner. So we have got lots of fun. So let's get a little background music going just to make it a little more interesting. So let's go. The VW Boys, ladies and gentlemen, playing our background music. All right, so let's see if these are some things you may not know about the Andy Griffith Show. A lot of you are going to know this, but hey, let's have fun with it. All right, so did you know, was Mayberry a real place? Do you know the answer to that? Many fans of the Andy Griffith Show, they're of the opinion that the sleepy little town of Mayberry, North Carolina, was based on Andy Griffith's hometown of Mount Airy, North Carolina. I'm one of them. I'm one of them that believes that. But did you know that Andy Griffith himself denied those claims for years? He denied them for years. He'd say that it was not based on Mount Airy. Mount Airy's a real town with real problems, and it's got real issues they have to deal with, and everything in Mayberry was dealt with in 30 minutes. Now, we've definitely heard that before, but I don't necessarily believe that, because you'll think about it, even on the Andy Griffith Show, in Season 2, Episode 7, A Black Day for Mayberry, Barney was sitting there in the courthouse, and he picked up the phone book to search for a number. So I don't know what he was looking for a number for, because Sarah had all the phone numbers, but he was looking in the phone book, maybe just to see who lived in Mayberry. I don't know. But in that episode, when he picks it up, you can see really pretty clearly that on the front cover of that magazine or of that not magazine, but of that phone book, it said Mount Airy, North Carolina. That's right. The directory said Mount Airy. You can see it. Mount Airy right there. It was a real phone book, by the way, that was on the set of the fictional town of Mayberry that was from Mount Airy, Andy's hometown. And I can tell you this, too. In later years, Andy, who had always denied that the town of Mayberry was in any way related to Mayberry, North Carolina, and Mount Airy, that they were related to one another. He did come out and say, you know, a lot of folks have said this, but, you know, I guess it does sound like it. And that's because there's so many things around Mount Airy that are similar to Mayberry. Did you know that there's a Mount Pilot near Mount Airy, North Carolina? Well, it's Mount Pilot. It's Pilot Mountain instead of Mount Pilot. But on the Andy Griffith Show, it was Mount Pilot. Then in real life, there in Mayberry, it's Pilot Mountain. And then there's all kinds of other things right around the Mount Airy, North Carolina area. Now, I agree that the town of Mayberry is not Mount Airy, North Carolina. But I tell you what, it's about as close as you'll ever get when you go visiting. Okay? So, while Mayberry may not have been a real place, it was definitely based on the real town of Mount Airy, North Carolina. And it was really based on the time when Andy was a boy growing up in that small town. Because if you watch the Andy Griffith Show, it's much more like it was set back in the 30s and 40s than in the 60s. Okay. All right, so that's something you may not know. You may not know that. All right, so let's go on the next. Did you realize that Andy, in the first season, at least at the beginning, he was kind of written as a kind of a bumpkin? I guess as a hick, a country hick, a bumpkin. He spoke with a extreme accent. He had a southern accent. You really saw that. Much more like Will Stockdale, his character in No Time for Sergeants. And Andy had planned he was going to be the funny man. Andy Griffith's going to be the funny man of his own sitcom. You know, like Tim the Tool Man Taylor was the funny man on his show. The star is usually the comedian on a TV show. But after just a few episodes of the Andy Griffith Show, Andy and the producers, they all agreed that Don Knotts, Don Knotts' character, that he should be the funny man. He should play the one that's going to be the comic. That's when, if you watch the episodes from the beginning to the end, Andy kind of starts to move away from being that real country-fied person to being a much more level-headed and sophisticated. He's justice of the peace, and he kind of controls. He's the sane one there in Mayberry. We all know that. You've all seen that many times. He's kind of the sane person. Everybody else around him is crazy. You got Barney and Goober and all those folks. But Andy's the sane one. So he goes from being that country bumpkin. He made that decision because it was his show. And he had the right to do that. But he saw Don Knotts and realized just what kind of a person Don Knotts was and how amazing he was as that comic. And Andy stepped back and became the straight man for the entire little town of Mayberry. And now then it was up to those people in the town, all the other townspeople, to create problems that Sheriff Andy Taylor had to solve, which was just unusual. But Andy deserves a lot of respect for that. You know, Don won Emmys for the show, and Andy never did. And I got to tell you, being the straight man around a bunch of funny people, that's hard. And Andy did it amazingly. So he went from a comedic person to that straight man, much more level-headed, the sane one that kept everything going there in Mayberry. So, yeah, the town was definitely a big part of that. All right, so next up, let's talk about a similar thing here about the patrol car. Did you ever notice that Sheriff Taylor and Barney Fife always had a brand new squad car every year? This was a little bitty town. And every season of the Andy Griffith Show, they had a brand new car. They got a brand new car every year. Now, can you imagine? I grew up in a small town. They never got new squad cars. I mean, when they did, it was a big deal. People was like, oh, look, it's new car. But they got a new car every year because it was brand spanking new. It wasn't because they kept it washed and cleaned up. It's because the Andy Griffith Show was sponsored by the Ford Motor Company. So if you watch the end of the episode, you'll see that. And so they got a brand new Ford Galaxy every year from a local dealership there in California. So they would get it, they get the car, they bring it in, they paint it up like a squad car, and then you would see it throughout the season, you know, whatever model year it was. So you had the 1960, 61, 62, 1963, all those new model years of squad cars, you got to see it as they went through. So the one I think of the most is the 1963 squad car. It had the headlights side by side, and anyway, it was the one I always thought of. Now, it was a Galaxy, and some of them, they were just Galaxies. They weren't Galaxy 500s, so they had a little bit less chrome and things like that. So a lot of the squad cars you see that are replicas, like the one I have, is a Galaxy 500, 1963, but they weren't 500s. But there were a different one every season from the first season up through when they started the color episodes. And really, you only saw the color ones. You only saw it in 1965. You saw that car. But you really didn't see the last three, a few seasons there. You did not see a squad car. You just didn't see it. So anyway, they got a brand new car, and they would go back to the dealer at the end of the season, and the dealer would sell them as used cars or whatever. So there's no real record of any of those squad cars actually still existing, other than the rumor that there's one at the Melody Ranch in California. There's supposedly one there, but so far, no one that I know has seen it, other than I think Stark Howell. That's Hoke House's son. He told me that he had seen it. So that's the only person I've heard it from that's actually seen the car. So there is a Mayberry squad car that was supposedly the one that was actually used on the show there at the Melody Ranch. It was Gene Autry's, by the way. Gene Autry owned Melody Ranch. Now, Melody Ranch, in case you don't know that, Melody Ranch is where they filmed a whole bunch of old TV shows and movies. They filmed them there. It's like a back lot, or they have old Western town and old Spanish town, like where Zorro would have been. And they filmed those movies there. So anyway, there's supposed to be one there, but they got a brand new car every season. That was the main thing I want you to walk away with. All right. So did you know that, Howard McNear, who played Floyd the Barber, he never moved his left hand in later episodes. Did you ever notice that? His left hand. Did you notice he's never actually really standing up by himself either, really, after those first couple of years? You probably never did really notice that, because they did a pretty good job of hiding it. So after Howard McNear, Floyd the Barber, he suffered a stroke. He had a stroke during the season. So it was right after the episode where the convicts had captured Barney and Floyd up in the cabin. So it was right after that he had a stroke. All right. So right after that, you know, they ended up bringing him back eventually a year later. So it took him about a year to recover enough to be able to come back. But he couldn't move his left hand after that, not very well. It didn't move very well. He could move it. I mean, he could move it around, but not really do much with it. He usually was holding a newspaper or his brush or something like that in that hand, if you watch the episodes. So they tried to hide it, and they actually built a special little, it's called a boatswain. I'm sure I'm not saying this right, but it's a nautical term. And they'd hang it on the back of the barber chair. And he would sit in it as he pretended to cut Andy's hair or Barney's hair or whatever he's doing. And so he never really, he didn't have to stand too much. He would kind of lean on something or kind of be near somebody. So just start watching the episodes and you'll notice that Howard, he couldn't really walk very well. And he didn't walk much. There's even times where you'll hear Andy will be sitting at his desk and you'll hear the door kind of open, and Andy will look over and say, oh, hey, Floyd. And you'll see Floyd looking in the door. Hey, Andy. He said, well, come on in. And then it cuts back to Andy. He says, well, come on in, Floyd. And you can hear Floyd walking. And Andy's still looking over there. He says, well, what did you hear, Floyd? And then it cuts to him, and he's already sitting in the little chairs that are along the side of Andy's desk. So you'll see that. Just start watching for that kind of stuff. Now, all that said is really just to talk about just how much Andy Griffith admired, and not just Andy, but the cast, how they loved Howard McNair. And when he had his stroke, they went and did the best they could to get him back on the show. They made all kinds of changes. And if you listen, if you watch, Floyd really went from the real hyper, oh, jumping around guy to like talking like, hello, Andy. Yeah, did you see that? He went into the much slower, drawled, slow talking. Anyway, of course, I really enjoy Floyd. So it's something you wouldn't have noticed. I never noticed it until I found out about it. And then, I could see it. But Howard McNair was such a amazing character that they wanted to make sure he came back on the show. Anyways, that's something you may not have known. All right, so next up, we're going to talk about deputy or no deputy. Yeah, deputy or no deputy. Despite Deputy Barney Fife being featured as one of the, I don't know, the main character on the Andy Griffith Show, besides Andy, yeah, he wasn't originally written in as like a permanent role. In fact, the producers didn't write up a formal contract for Don Knotts until after he actually came on the show. In that first episode, they saw him and he was in it, and they're like, oh, we got to put him under contract and get him in here in season one. You know, and he wasn't in the pilot that was on the Danny Thomas show. He contacted Andy and said, you know what you really need on that show? You need a deputy. So Andy said, you know, I think you're right. So he put him in touch with Aaron Rubin, and he came in and read for it and then was cast as Deputy Barney Fife. But I didn't know that, you know, he didn't really have a contract going into the season until after they filmed that first episode. And we have got to put him under contract. So he was signed to a 5-year contract, and both he and Andy thought the show would end after 5 years. Because that was kind of a normal run for a show. Just it doesn't last longer than 5 years. So they both believed it would be over after 5 years. So he signed a 5-year contract. And then at the end of that, toward the end of that fifth year, he started looking for other work because the show was probably going to end, is going to be over its fifth year. So he went out and signed a deal there in that fifth year with Universal Pictures. And so Andy eventually made the decision he's going to keep the show going. Well, by then, Don had already signed this 5-year deal with Universal Pictures. So it came up with a lot more conversations back and forth. And Don was, I can't really, I've already signed this deal with Universal Pictures. I don't want to miss out on this opportunity, but you know, if you'll make me a partner, because Andy owned 51% of the Andy Griffith Show. So he wanted Andy to make him a partner. And while Andy and Don were great friends, they were always great friends, Andy didn't want to do the partnership because he was afraid, I believe, that it would impact their friendship once that happened. So he didn't agree to that. And so basically Don returned, he agreed to, or offered to come back for returned episodes, but he was not a regular member. And of course he went off and made those great movies like Ghost and Mr. Chicken, my favorite, How to Frame a Fig, Incredible Mr. Limpet. He went off and did all that with Universal. So he had a great career there, but we all miss him from the Andy Griffith Show, of course. But Andy and Don really were great friends. They were even together. Andy went to see Don before he passed away, and they spoke often. Now, as part of that friendship that we're talking about, this is something else you may not know. In many episodes of the Andy Griffith Show, Barney refers to Andy as Ange. You've heard him do that, right? Ange. All right, Ange. Well, this was actually a nickname that Don Knotts used to refer to Andy Griffith. They called him Ange. And it just kind of rolled through onto the actual show. So he used Ange as a shortened version of Andy, right? It was just that's just what he did. And Andy actually called Don Knotts Jess because his name was Jesse. Jesse Donald Knotts. So he called him that. So they were very close friends off screen, and that's where the nickname came from. They first met on the set of the No Time for Sergeants movie in 1958. I'm sorry. And then they reunited on TV in 1960 for the Andy Griffith Show. But their friendship transcended beyond their professional career. They were together all that time, both Don and Andy. Great friends. And, that's a real relationship that you got to respect. Those two loved each other. Oh, I should mention, too, he called him Ange when he's talking about Andy. And you remember Don and Andy were also on Matlock together. Andy brought Don in on Matlock, and he didn't call him Ben Matlock. He called him Binge. So evidently Don just kind of had that in his personality to give nicknames to his friends. So at least for Andy. So he was Ange on the Andy Griffith Show, and he was Binge on Matlock. So there's a couple of other things that you may not have known. So I hope you enjoyed that. Before we go on to hear from Randy Turner in This Week in Mayberry History, I have a voicemail that's referring to some stuff from the last couple of weeks. So let's hear from Paul. Go ahead, Paul. Take it away.
Hey, Alan, it's Paul Mulick calling in again. In a recent podcast, you were talking about the life plate number AY321 that it appears on Aunt B's car, among others. They use that one a bunch. In fact, it's on Otis's car in Hot Rod Otis, and it's on Uncle Ollie's car in Family Visit, and it's on Bonnie's car, the blue Edsel that he drives in the color episodes. Also, you were talking about the phone system. I always kind of figured that since, as Andy said, everybody in town knew that the Mendelbrot sisters used the phone on Sunday afternoon, that Sarah just kind of took the afternoon off, you know, maybe like from 1 o'clock on or something like that. Don't have any proof of that, just a guess. Keep up the good work. 10-4, over and out. Bye. I already 10-4'd you.
Thanks, Paul. And, you know, you're probably right. The afternoon, speaking about the phones, because we were talking about that, or somebody had mentioned it to me, and I can't remember who it was now, so I'm sorry. But, during that same episode, before all the Mendelbrights taking over the phone lines, Mr. Tucker had gone over to the gas station. Remember, he stole Gomer's truck. He stole the truck there from Wally's. And Gomer ran up to the phone and said, Sarah, get me the sheriff. You remember so she was there at that point. So maybe you're right. Maybe she took the afternoon off or at least some part of the day off so the Mendelbrot sisters could talk to one another and everybody else was good to go. So I like that theory as well. So, folks, if you have a theory about things like that, let me know. So we also heard about the AY321 being on Otis's car, Ollie's car, and Barney's car. When Barney, he had actually a car in the color episodes when he came back. Cool. Thank you, Paul. Thanks for that information. Man, I love you guys. You come up with all kinds of great stuff to help share and make the show and give us more information. There's no way I can have it all. So thank you. If you have information like that, please let me know. Give me a call and bring it in here like Paul did. So thank you. All right. So let's go in here from Randy.
Welcome to This Week in Mayberry History, a report by special correspondent Randy Turner of the Gomer and Cooper Pyle Comic Book Literary Guild of the Mayberry Historical Society.
John Lorimer was a busy character actor over a 37-year career who frequently played different characters in the same series, including in our favorite series. John was born on May 7, 1906, in Canton, Ohio. He was involved in high school theater productions, graduating from McKinley High School in Canton in 1924. After graduation, John moved an hour north to Cleveland, where he paid his bills working as a bank teller while studying at what is now the Case School of Engineering, and also studying drama at the Cleveland Playhouse. The Playhouse is the first professional regional theater in the United States, but was only 10 years old when John began his studies there. For the rest of the decade, John acted in local theater in northern Ohio, and soon was also managing the Cleveland Playhouse. Toward the end of the 1920s, he moved to New York City, where he sought a career on the stage. Not long after he moved, he teamed with a man who was a singer and dancer, and they formed a revue in which John was billed as a monologist. John would perform a series of character sketches in which he played a wide variety of people without the use of costumes, props, or special makeup, using his voice alone to evoke the characters. By 1930, John and his partner had returned to Canton, where they continued to perform their revue, and where John became the director of a local organization that performed plays, usually in association with the local PTA or with the Boy Scouts of America. John remained in Canton for a couple of years, even though the revue act he performed with ended, then returned to New York City. John was involved in theaters in both the city and in New Jersey. By 1936, he had made it to Broadway, where he appeared in three productions during the first half of the year, though none was long-running. He continued to act in New York until World War II. John served in Europe during the war for 3 years. After the war's conclusion, he returned to New York City in 1946 and worked with the American Theater Wing program until 1956. He had also begun performing in television and film during that period, debuting in the anthology show The Ford Theater Hour in 1950. John's stage experience served him well, and he did a good deal of work in similar anthology shows, many of which were broadcast live. His film work was usually small and credited roles, but he was a busy character actor in television. While he most often played different roles in multiple appearances in series, he did sometimes play recurring characters, such as in the Western series Lawman during the 1958-1959 season, as Farmer Sam Watkins in 10 episodes of The Real McCoys between 1959 and 62, and the Medical Examiner in a dozen episodes of Perry Mason between 1959 and 63. He also made his first of four appearances in The Twilight Zone in 1960. In 1962, John appeared for the first time in The Andy Griffith Show as Fletch Dilbeck, whose truck was sideswiped by a spoiled, rich young man played by Bill Bixby. Early the next season, John was Tate Fletcher, who had his cow stolen until Andy solved the case. And in the fifth season, John returned a final time to play Parnell Rigsby, whose change purse was found by Opie. John continued to be an in-demand character actor for many years. He is remembered for playing Judge Irwin Chester in 18 episodes of Peyton Place, and his frequent appearances in Lassie. He also appeared frequently in westerns, such as The Big Valley, The Wild Wild West, Bonanza, Gunsmoke, and Alias Smith and Jones. He reunited with Bill Bixby in a 1979 episode of The Incredible Hulk. He appeared in the pilot for the original Star Trek and in two additional episodes, including the classic For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky. John made his final television appearance in 1984 and passed away in 1986. His last film role was in a movie released in 1987 after he had passed away. Well, that's it for this week. As always, thank you for listening. And remember to take Andy's advice and go out there and act like somebody.
Oh, man. Thank you so much, Randy Turner, for this week in Mayberry history. And folks, if you want to make sure you don't miss any of the great things that Randy's doing in and around the town of Mayberry, send him an email at turnersgrade@gmail.com, and he'll make sure you don't miss anything. I'd never heard of a monologist. I was just asking Randy, what kind of ologist was he? A monologist. So he played one role. I think that's what that means. Wow. I'd never heard that. Yeah, it's a speaker or writer of a monologue. There we go. Man, Randy's education is worth every penny. Mono being that he acted by himself. Man, see, you get good information from Randy and just random thoughts from me, basically. That's why I put him toward the end normally, because you'll stick around better. No, I'm so glad you're here. I hope you have enjoyed all of the fun that we've been having tonight and all these little bits and pieces of Mayberry information that I provided to you. If you did, please let me know and encourage me to keep doing these, because keep doing those type of episodes, because those are kind of fun to me, because they're little facts and things that I've picked up over the years that are just things that I think everybody knows, but then I began to realize that I'm not sure everybody does, or that they don't remember them. So it's worth repeating them here on the podcast. So folks, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for being here with me, and I'd love to hear from you. You can give me a call at 888-684-8415, just like Paul Mulick did, or you can just head over to twochairsnowaiting.com and click the contact button. Folks, we will see you next week here on Two Chairs. Have a great week.
You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavor swirling together with cold brew topped with a velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. And that imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. Participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.